morning, and welcome to Power for the People for June 4th here on Community Radio WERU-FM. I'm your host, Steve Call. Longtime listeners know that the goal of Power for the People is to help Mainers to understand and take control of their energy future, which of course includes their energy costs. I think today's program may be the best example of that possibility. We're here to discuss LD 1646, which is sponsored, originally sponsored by Seth Berry, has a number of other sponsors, including Nicole Grohowski, who from Ellsworth, who is here in the studio with me. So LD 1646 is an act to restore local ownership and control of Maine's power delivery systems, and it would establish the Maine Power Delivery Authority. As you know, this is normally a call-in program, but the Tuesday time slot that Power of the People is in conflicts with the legislative session. So this program is being recorded in Augusta, and therefore, unfortunately, no calls are being taken in this program. So, again, Representative Berry is here with us, and he has been the mover and shaker behind this, I guess. You are from Bodenham.
That's right, yeah.
And you are the chair of the... Help me with the name of the committee here.
It's called the Joint Standing Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology.
Okay, and so the bill is going through that committee.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, and Representative Grohowski, who is with us and is a co-sponsor, is also on the committee. So you have two of the 13 members right here with you.
Right, and there's 8 or 10 sponsors of the bill?
That's right. Yes, I actually don't know offhand. 8 or 9, I think, and a great bipartisan team. Senate President Troy Jackson is my lead co-sponsor, and I'm very pleased that my former co-chair, Republican Senator David Woodsum, is a co-sponsor, and Senator Marianne Moore, a Republican from down East Maine, is also a co-sponsor.
Right. And the people that are in the WERU listening area include Nicole, and let's see, there's somebody from Camden. Brian Hubble from Bar Harbor is in the listening area for WERU, as is Senator Moore that you just mentioned. But of course, remember, WERU can be heard anywhere in the universe at weru.org. So it's not just these areas. But thank you for being here, Nicole, at relatively short notice, because of course this is in your district. So Seth Berry is a six-term representative of District 55, which is Bodenham and part of Richmond, and he's former majority leader, I discovered in reading things online, and that's interesting. He's vice president of Kennebec River Bioscience in Richmond, which is a Maine-owned biotechnology firm. And again, as I mentioned a moment ago, Representative Berry serves as the House Chair of the Joint Standing Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology. And Joint Standing Committee means it's both representatives and senators.
That's right.
On that committee,
yeah.
Right. Nicole Grohowski is a first-term representative from Ellsworth, also representing part of Trenton, I believe. All of Trenton, okay. And I think I gathered from your information online that you are a Maine master naturalist.
That is true.
Which is something that I've dabbled with becoming because I teach the environmental stuff and ecology at Thomas College. You're a board member of the Northern Forest Canoe Trail, and I have to say, as a paddler, I did pick up on the fact that you were the first woman to paddle the entire trail. So way to go. Fantastic. And you're also a member of the Joint Standing Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Technology. So LD 1646 does have support from a coalition of ratepayers and even some staff, I understand. But give us a little bit of idea about how we came to this point of feeling that this is something we needed to do.
Sure. Well, for me, this goes way back, if anything, it goes back to the 70s when I got involved as a 10-year-old in the Maine Yankee referendum. So even then, I was battling CMP at some level. But it began with my election in 2006 to the House of Representatives in Maine, and I asked to serve on the Energy Committee, and just like Representative Grohowski, I was a freshman legislator coming in and saw this committee as a priority for the simple reason that our energy future means everything. You know, we're facing an enormous global climate crisis, and Maine needs to be a leader in addressing that crisis because we have so much at stake. You know, and even then, for me, it was my top priority and my reason for my biggest reason for wanting to be elected to the legislature. And what I found very quickly was that there were two principal opponents to every effort to do something good that we made in the committee. One of them was fossil fuel dealers, oil dealers, for example, and it wasn't so much individuals, but the association that represented them. And the other was Central Maine Power and Emera Maine, the two large transmission distribution monopolies in Maine, who opposed our efforts to modernize the grid through efficiency and save both money and power and prevent emissions by enacting more aggressive efficiency measures, and also opposed our ability to take back our power and to green up our power supply through more distributed generation, such as rooftop solar. And as everyone who's paid any attention knows, over the last several years, CMP and Emera have again and again pushed back our ability to deploy rooftop solar effectively. They are the reason that the Public Utilities Commission under Governor LePage enacted a world-class bungle called gross metering. It was something never done before in the history of the world.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah. So anyway, there were some frustrations there. And it was clear to me that the system was broken, at least for the people of Maine. It worked very well for the international investors in Central Maine Power and Emera Maine, but it did not work well for Maine customers, whether they're business customers or residential customers, and it didn't work well for the environment. So that was the fundamental dynamic that I was confronted with and that I've seen play itself out again and again and again during my going on 11 years, I guess, in the Maine legislature. And more recently, we've also seen incredible rate increases. The transmission, which is the higher voltage component of our delivery rates, has quadrupled in the last 10 years. And that's because of build out that has happened across the New England grid, which has been driven by policies which basically line the pockets of those investor owned utilities. And we all know about the billing and metering problems that CMP has had. I think that's just another example of mismanagement and wrongly placed priorities. So I was looking around for alternatives and came across consumer-owned utilities and the century-old, more than century-old track record that they have of delivering reliable, lower-cost power to their customers by removing the profit incentive and just having the customer as the priority. So that's why we proposed this bill and are working very hard to get it through here in Augusta.
And one of the issues that's out there has been in the media plenty is billing problems with CMP, which seems to be related to layoffs, I guess, in their customer service department. Any comment from any of your constituents on that?
Absolutely. I mean, there are thousands of ratepayers who have joined together, and there's been more activity at the Public Utilities Commission than I think ever in their history with respect to customer complaints. CMP has essentially lied about the billing and metering crisis that they're having. They told all customers and all elected officials that their billing and metering situation had been rectified and that everything was working. It's not. What the audit report that recently concluded stated was that over 100,000 billing and metering errors have occurred affecting customers, and that more continue to crop up. And also that over half of the meters that CMP has have a defect which has not been rectified, even though CMP has known about it for at least 4 years.
Well, and in my case, actually, I'm going to know more by the end of the month because I put meters on all my equipment and shut down my heat pumps for the month of May. And so I'm going to be able to see whether my meter is accurate, because frankly, my electric bill, granted, I did put in two heat pumps, but I put them in one at a time, and my electric bill is higher than I think it ought to be. And Efficiency Maine falls under the jurisdiction of this committee. They actually put meters on the heat pumps. So I actually have the data. So I think I can do a heck of a job come the end of the month on this stuff. So I appreciate your comments. Any comments that you've heard from your constituents?
Well, I am in a different territory. So representing Ellsworth and Trenton, all of my constituents are in the Ameris service territory. So I think we have been lucky in recent years with no billing issues, but certainly I know there have been issues in the past with service for Ameris customers. So I think it just sort of depends on who gets the scrutiny from the State House and from the PUC, and then, you know, their improvements are made until things slip again. So I don't think that just because things are going well now means they will go well forever.
Right.
I'm certainly paying a high price.
And we do have the uncertainty of Ameris apparently being up for sale or something happening there. So, again, not to a main company.
I'm very concerned about the NMAX proposal. To me, it has shades of Fairpoint taking over Verizon. I was here for that debacle back in 2007, 2008. That was, there was an attempt to block it in the legislature, and it was unsuccessful. But many of the same questions that were being asked then about Fairpoint and their ability to take over Verizon's phone lines are being asked now about the NMAX deal. And I think we need to really scrutinize that proposal. It's very distant utility all the way out in Calgary, you know, on the other side of the continent, that's being asking for permission to take over Maine's lines. They've never done this before. They have zero experience with it. And we've seen what happened when Iberdrola, a very distant company, took over CMP's lines. The result has not been pretty. So I think we need to be on guard about this.
Right. So, and there's a couple of other things going on here. One is there's movement within, I think there's still legislation or at least discussion around energy independence for the state of Maine. And frankly, I think that's what Mainers are all about, is being in control of their own situation. Can you comment on, are there bills pending on that?
Well, when you say energy independence, I think it means different things to different people. Certainly, our committee and the Democratic majority in the House and the Senate and the governor as well are very committed to increasing the amount of renewables that are on the grid, and also to beneficial electrification. The way that we address the climate crisis is through electrification of transportation, which is responsible for about half of our energy use, and is obviously mostly fossil fuels right now, and through beneficial electrification of building heating and cooling. And essentially what we need to do is triple the demand on the grid. So to become truly energy independent, we need to do that. But then also, the goal of energy independence just implies that we're only worried about our own consumption and making sure that is fully generated here locally. I think Maine has a bigger opportunity than just energy independence. Maine's opportunity is to become a source of clean, renewable energy for the entire region. And I think the CMP corridor, which we may discuss later, would to some extent short circuit our ability to do that. We just passed an offshore wind bill that would move us in the right direction with respect to the great work that's going on at the University of Maine. Even a small part of the federal waters 15 miles offshore could provide all the power that is needed for Maine, as well as much of New England. And combine that with solar and hydro and other existing renewables, storage as well, you have a very nice combination that can do more than just make Maine energy independent.
Right.
We can help the region.
Right. No, that sounds great. It is curious to me, and has been for a while, that the resistance to things like solar, as you just mentioned a moment ago. I'm in Ameris territory, put solar on my place at the lake, and and under Bangor Hydro. And it's the ultimate simple thing is that it's running the meter backwards. The fact that the gross metering requires an extra meter and extra spreadsheet use, as I understand it from CMP, I just don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense.
One of the things that really struck me in a meeting that we had with people who are interested in investing in larger scale renewables in Maine was the fact that one of their big hurdles in terms of timing and planning is that they're not getting information in a timely fashion from our transmission and distribution utilities in order to find out, you know, is the grid able to accept this load at this location? How do we interface with the grid? So they've said that they know many instances where there were people willing to invest and they just went elsewhere because they weren't getting information fast enough. So that was another hurdle that I hadn't even thought about with the utility that's less than excited sometimes about adding renewables directly, large scale renewables to their grid.
And your comment about EVs, electric vehicles and electric home heating and solar are all topics we've talked about on this program. And if anybody wants to go back and look, you can go to archives.weru.org. anywhere in the universe, and take a look at those past programs. You mentioned briefly that there's both parties are represented as sponsors on this, and part of the thing that I think we need to emphasize is that this is a big idea, but it's not a partisan idea. Should be supported by both parties. I was just looking at headlines last night, and if I recall correctly, it was the governor of Maryland, who is a Republican, is about to veto a bill down there because it doesn't go far enough in terms of getting them to renewables. And so again, it's not a partisan issue. Climate change is phenomenally controversial, but this is an economic issue and a service issue and a reliability issue.
It is, and local control is a principle that I think both Republicans and Democrats can agree on. It's something, it's certainly a big part of Maine's political tradition. And that's what the bill is about, first and foremost, is restoring local control. Consumer-owned utilities also exist in Maine, both rural Republican areas and urban and suburban Democratic areas. We have consumer-owned utilities in Kennebunk and Madison and Holton and Callis. And I could go on. And they are cheaper and more reliable than Emera or Central Maine Power. And if you zoom out nationally and look across the 49 and 50 states that have consumer-owned power, many of those utilities are quite large. They serve an entire state, which also is a very Republican red state. The state of Nebraska happens to have some of the lowest cost energy and the best reliability as of 2017. Maine has the worst reliability in 2017. So there's an important point of comparison. But Nebraska is just one example of many. There are large utilities across the Midwest that are consumer-owned. The entire city of Los Angeles is consumer-owned power. The Sacramento area. By the way, utilities in California had no problems with wildfires in the recent death of 85 people that was started by a utility, an investor-owned utility out there. So 49 to 50 states. And on average, consumer-owned power is 15% cheaper and more than twice as reliable as investor-owned power, which serves 6 of 7 Americans. Consumer-owned power in 49 states serves 1 in 7 Americans, and investor-owned power serves... Actually, 6 and 7 isn't quite right. There are cooperatives as well, which I'm not including in the total. If you add utilities that are consumer owned, set in the way that I'm proposing, and the cooperatives together, you get about 1 in 4. Isn't that right, Nicole? Mm-hmm. About 1 in 4 Americans served by some kind of consumer owned power.
So let's make sure that we always don't want to get ahead of the audience. Let's talk about what exactly a consumer-owned utility is.
So a consumer-owned utility is essentially like your typical water district or sewer district. A lot of people are familiar with those kinds of utilities because they tend to still exist as consumer-owned utilities. Electric utilities were set up in the same way when electricity first came along. They tended to be started up in the downtowns or the urban areas because those were the easiest to get to. And it was the rural parts of the country that were the hardest to reach. And it took until FDR and the New Deal and cooperatives to get to those harder to reach areas. And that's when, you know, Washington County with Eastern Maine Electric finally was electrified. But the type of utility that I'm proposing is sometimes referred to as a muni or a municipal power authority, even though it doesn't necessarily serve one municipality. A muni is referred to that way because it has that organization similar to your municipal water district or your municipal sewer district, et cetera. It is governed by a board of directors or trustees. Its fiduciary responsibility is only to its customers. And that's very important because in an investor-owned utility, the fiduciary responsibility is to the investors first and to the customers second. And the other key distinction is that they are financed differently. An investor-owned utility is financed through a mix of equity and debt. And the equity is very expensive because investors expect a high rate of return. Consumer-owned utilities are financed through lower interest revenue bonds. And revenue bonds are different from the bonds that we vote on in the fall. They are not supported by taxes. Revenue bonds are supported through a predictable stream of revenue, which in the case of utilities is your electric bill. So utilities that are consumer-owned currently will go to, when they need to borrow, they will go to bond banks and say, you know, we need to borrow X amount. We can pay it back because here's the revenue that our customers will continue to pay in through their electric bills. Typically, revenue bonds are being sold right now for about 3% interest. The investor-owned utilities, the equity portion of their financing is between 10 and 13% interest right now. And that doesn't necessarily sound like a lot to people that don't understand finance, but you know, to your listeners who do understand finance, the difference between 3% and 10 to 13% is just staggering. You know, and I can kind of walk through an example of that if you like. But again, the two key distinctions between consumer-owned utilities and investor-owned utilities are who controls them. It's the customers through an elected or appointed board. In the case of consumer-owned utilities, in investor-owned utilities, it is the investors that control them. They are regulated, and we can talk more about how regulation works. But they are given a monopoly franchise, and the other key distinction is the financing, lower interest versus higher interest financing.
And then you've also got the profit expectation for the investor.
Correct. And that's why the financing is structured the way it is. Because of that, what's called in regulatory rate making, it's called the revenue requirement of the investors. They require a certain level of return. And that is why baked into our electrical rates, there is a very high, again, 10 to 13% rate of return for the investors in CMP, for example, who are primarily from Qatar and Norway and Spain. If Emera is sold to NMAX, the investors there will be the city of Calgary making money off of Maine customers. And that's unnecessary. And it drives a lot of bad decision-making to overbuild portions of the grid, to build out transmission and distribution lines where they're not needed, because there is such a wonderful profit to be made off the backs of Maine customers.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, in learning about this, being new to this committee, I was pretty astounded that you would get that level of return for something that we know everyone is using and using reliably and paying their bills. It seems like a very safe investment to invest in a utility, electric utility. So I was kind of astounded by the rate that these investors are, you know, guaranteed.
Right. And it's money going out of state rather than staying in state. Yeah. So part of the positive part of this, I guess, is that it's not like we're going to destroy the utility. We're not going to take down all the poles and start over again.
That's right.
The staff is going to remain. Yep. It's just a change in ownership, rather like it happened when a Spanish company bought CMP. Yep. Right? So except that, as you just said, we have every expectation that the rates are going to go down as a result of that, and with local control, we would have better reliability.
That's exactly right. Would it be helpful, Steve, if we just kind of walk through what the bill would do? Just sure. A quick overview
yep.
of that.
Yep, that's exactly where I was going.
I think you have already stated that it would create the main power delivery authority, and that would be a consumer-run utility. And what you just said is important as well. It would acquire all the existing transmission and distribution assets of CMP and Emera Maine, and the owners would have to be compensated fairly for that takeover. We would be simply purchasing at the net book value, which is their own stated value of those assets, the transmission and distribution lines, the poles and wires, if you will. We're not interested in taking over other obligations that those companies may have. For example, there's nuclear waste that is still in Wiscasset. You know, they can keep that. We can talk about some of their pension obligations. But the poles and wires would be purchased, and they would be financed through these lower interest revenue bonds that I mentioned. So you're essentially it's like more refinancing your house. If you have a mortgage on your house and you can refinance at a lower rate, you'd be crazy not to do it. You know, we this is something we can't afford not to do. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is very important for people to understand, because the question I sometimes hear is, well, gee, can we afford to do that? You know, and that's exactly the wrong question. The question is, can we afford not to do that?
Right.
We expect that rates will go down. When Long Island was converted to public power or consumer-owned power in 1998, the rates went down 20%. I'm not predicting that that's what would happen here, but we do expect the rates would go down. No tax dollars involved. You know, we've talked about the financing as separate from tax dollars, and the bill, in fact, makes very clear that the authority would have no access to tax dollars and would be divorced from the state's general fund in that way. The fiduciary responsibility obviously shifts to customers. And the board, which holds that responsibility, is comprised of a nonpartisan, independent 10-member board, and it would represent different customer classes, so residential to large industrial, and different geographic areas as well. The board that I envision would be nominated by governors and confirmed by legislatures after a public hearing. So there'd be a public vetting process of the governing officials. And they would hold their meetings in public. They would be subject to freedom of access laws. You know, right now,
right, different than it is now.
Right now, if you want to get in on the decision making of CMP, the real decision making, you need to learn Spanish, fly to Bilbao, Spain, and beat down a locked door to get in, because that's where the real decisions are being made. With this utility, the main power delivery authority. Everyone will be able to access and participate in those transparent, customer-centered meetings. You mentioned that the existing staff would be retained, and there would be an obligation to protect the retirement plans and the benefits and the wages of those workers. And importantly as well, the revenues to municipalities, the property tax revenues that are currently collected, would be protected. There's a little bit of a confusion about that. I think the bill needs to be tightened up in that respect. But there's a component called payment in lieu of taxes, which is very important to municipalities to retain those property tax mm-hmm. benefits that we currently receive and pay for, by the way, as part of our rates. So that's essentially what it does. And I don't know if Nicole wants to add anything.
One of the things that I found really interesting during the testimony was Senator Marianne Moore, who's from down East Maine, from Callis, in fact. She came and spoke to us about her experience because she lives actually in a cooperative, the Eastern Maine Electric Co-op. And this was very interesting to me. Having grown up in Ellsworth, I actually had no idea that this co-op existed. For most, I think it's 60% of Washington County that's covered by it. And in doing a little of my own research, I saw that they pay about 8.5 cents for transmission and distribution per kilowatt hour. And we in the Emera territory are paying nearly 11 cents. And so obviously that adds up very quickly over time. The other thing that was very interesting in her testimony that I had not even thought about was that she said they actually recently were given a dividend. So they found that their rates were higher than they needed for their operations, and she got a dividend check. I don't know that anyone has ever considered getting money back from their utility, and that really sort of wowed me.
I lived in New Hampshire and taught in the University of New Hampshire system for a while, and did a number of solar projects over there, including 140 kilowatts on a sewer district, which is running 60% of their electricity. But we also did a net zero project on public office building. And over there, per their PUC rules, which could be related to the dividend thing, this building actually, not only was it net zero, it's produced 3 megawatt hours more than it's used. When you get to a certain level, and this is the New Hampshire Electric Co-op, they pay you for it. Yeah. Right. And so it'd be great to think that we could do that sort of thing here as well to encourage solar.
So
it'd make a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
And just to comment on your 11 cents versus 8 cents, I mean, when we're talking cents, it sounds, you know, like your bill is 3 cents different a month, but that's per kilowatt hour.
Right.
So it's like a, whatever it is, 25% lower rate. Mm-hmm. So it makes a big difference.
If I can just jump in there, that's incredibly important to our industrial sector as well. You know, Maine has lost some of its manufacturing base, and that's a problem because those are foundational jobs. They're, you know, manufacturing jobs are the jobs that that really bring money into the state, typically. Tourism does that as well. There are some other sectors of the economy. But manufacturing is a very important part of Maine's economy still. And our manufacturers are incredibly sensitive to electricity costs. You know, Bath Iron Works, for example, if electricity costs go up 1 cent, that's $1 million per year that they lose. And, you know, they have to compete with a utility in the southern part of the United States, with a shipbuilder in the southern part of the United States, which is served by a consumer-owned utility and has much cheaper power. So that's one example. Another is Sappi in Skowhegan. They've invested a lot in that plant. They seem very committed to staying here in Maine. But for them, a 1 cent difference means $2 million a year, twice even what BIW would pay. So, you know, they are also part of the coalition that is pushing this conversation forward. And I think very, very interested in the idea of consumer-owned power for that reason.
So it's not just homeowners' electric bills. It's jobs for the state, no question about it. So we are in a non-regulated regulatory situation here with our utilities. One question I have, and I don't know the answer to this question, are the small COUs that are out there, do they generate power or are they distribution only?
They do generate power. So our existing consumer and utilities have essentially been grandfathered. And just for your listeners to back up, 20 years ago, as a reminder, Maine required the two large utilities, what are now AmeriMaine and Central Maine Power, to sell off all of the generation assets. And the idea of that was to create a free market for generation, to require that the risk be shifted to investors. Generation doesn't have to be a monopoly. Electrical delivery really does have to be a monopoly. You can't have two sets of poles and wires going down each street, or three or four. You know,
it would be incredibly
inefficient and expensive, and would also be dangerous in the case of electricity. So the idea of utilities generally is that they are natural monopolies, and that they need to be regulated or they need to be consumer owned for that reason, because they are monopolies. But with generation, you can have competition. And so in most of New England, every state but Vermont, in the late 90s, the states passed laws requiring the utilities to divest of their generation assets and to create a free market, if you will. And there are debates about how well that has worked, but the consumer-owned utilities were grandfathered, so they still do have the ability to own generation, and some of them choose to do that, some do not. But we would not, this bill, LD 1646, would not touch the consumer utilities. It would leave them alone to continue doing the great job that they're doing now. And it would also preserve the separation between generation and delivery that exists for our larger utilities.
So this is referring, this proposal is only for CMP and Emera?
And only for delivery, that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a moment ago relative to, you may have said something like resistance to efficiency, the Booth Bay project everybody's nodding at. It was covered on this program probably a year and a half ago, but the savings there were incredible, and CMP resisted doing that, and the PUC forced them to do it. And so there's a lot of reasons, I think, for a local control to make a lot of sense.
Exactly. And for folks that don't remember that, CMP came in, said, a lot of air conditioners are being turned on in the summertime in Booth Bay. We need to build out the transmission lines there to serve that peninsula, and it's going to cost ratepayers $18 million to do it. Actually, that was the upfront cost. And then that would be amortized with high interest rates over time, so it would end up costing something approximating $100 million over the years. A developer of solar energy projects and efficiency came into the PUC and convinced them as a pilot to allow a non-wires alternatives project instead. He said he could do it for much less. And in fact, went ahead and did it. The developers are called Grid Solar, and they used solar power as well as storage, as well as other peak shaving and demand response to simply reduce the peak power demand in the summertime. Very innovative approach. And instead of $18 million up front, it was $6 million up front. And the savings, once amortized, were even greater than that. And so all of us in CMP's territory are paying less today because of that project. But again, that was a one-off. And there's we did pass a bill recently that will allow that kind of thing to go forward on a regular basis at the Public Utilities Commission. That's a great thing, but it doesn't address the more fundamental problems with our utility regulation model here.
So just a reminder, this is Power for the People here on WERU. My name is Steve Kahl, and our guests today are Seth Berry from the legislature, from the utilities, and I don't have that right in front of me. I never can get that right.
Energy Committee.
Utilities and Energy Committee, and also Nicole Grohowski from Ellsworth. And we are talking about LD 1646, which is an act to restore local ownership and control of Maine's power delivery systems. And the result of that would be to create the Maine Power Delivery Authority. And in short, it's to buy out Emera and CMP with lower interest bonds than they would have, not to continue to send investor money or consumer money to other countries, and to have more control over our systems here. So relative to a regulated market, my general understanding of Vermont, Green Mountain Power, is that they are way more accepting or encouraging of solar power than we are here in the state of Maine. What do you envision, and this may be wild speculation, but what do you envision if we indeed have this consumer-owned utility?
I think it would look a lot more like Vermont, because the true value of distributed resources like solar and efficiency would be recognized and built into the planning of our grid. And there would be, as Nicole mentioned, greater cooperation with renewable developers and with customers to move the entire state forward. Vermont is a fascinating example. It's sort of an in-between place between what I propose and what we have now. It is still investor-owned, but it's a B corporation, meaning that it has a triple bottom line: people, planet, and profits. And those goals are written into their bylaws. So the fiduciary responsibility that we've talked about is a little bit different for the investors in Green Mountain Power and for the management. But Nicole has some experience in Vermont. Do you want to share anything?
Not so much in this sector. I did used to live in Vermont, and I do have a number of friends who are still there. And interestingly, I was visiting one this fall, and he said that Green Mountain Power was offering an opportunity for people, even people who didn't have solar, to have Tesla power walls installed in their house, with a rebate in order to help work on that distribution of resources. And And for those people, if the power went out, they were going to be able to switch to the power that was stored in their power wall, which is phenomenal that the utility was offering this opportunity.
Well, in fact, I saw a project that was being installed in New Hampshire a year ago or so, probably. And so they laid out the various rebates. So they were getting, I can't remember whether they were getting a rebate from the state, but they were getting a rebate from the utility in addition to the 30% federal tax credit. And the cost to the consumer to put solar on the house was 45% of the list price when you after you factor those other things in. And we're still here at the 70% range because of the resistance, unfortunately, to out-of-state entities who aren't really concerned about that. To me, having local control just makes an awful lot of sense to do the right thing for the state of Maine, as you just said a few minutes ago, rather than the right thing for investors. So that makes a lot of sense. Let's see here.
Hearing?
So tell me, let's talk about the hearing and who the people are that have come out in support of this. Again, it should be, and I think is, a nonpartisan issue. And I guess I would ask the question, is it only the utilities who are speaking against this? I mean, they've got lobbyists running all over the State House, I believe.
Yeah, I was very impressed by the turnout and support of the bill at the hearing. Very, very pleased with that. We heard incredible support from the customers of both Emera Maine and Central Maine Power. We heard great support from the industrial sector. Senator Moore testified about her experience, as Nicole referenced. We heard from workers that they are very concerned, continue to be very concerned about the lack of safety and reliability, although just by virtue of the bill existing, they've already won some concessions regarding staffing levels, which is great. The industrial sector made some very compelling points about energy costs, and we've kind of covered some of that. We heard as well from renewables folks, large generators, that they have had trouble with interconnects. And gosh, I don't know. The hearing went on for hours, and
Maine's first public advocate.
That's right. Maine's first ever public advocate came and spoke in favor of the bill.
Barry Hobbins, who I think reports to your committee. Where does he stand on this?
He gave some very supportive testimony. I think technically he was neither for nor against. He wasn't advising. There were some suggestions that we might want to begin with a thorough analysis or study, if you will, and then come back in the second session. And I think that would be in January. And whether we pass the bill as printed or whether we amend it, that does need to happen first regardless, because the logistics of it and the legal analysis need to be fully analyzed in order for us to be able to go to the bond banks and sell the bonds, and in order for us to be able to take on the legal challenges that will inevitably come from the utilities. So that is the first step, and I think everyone agrees on that. It's just a matter of what the degree of commitment is to seeing it through, once we have the results of that analysis. But the testimony was overwhelmingly supportive. I was incredibly pleased with the turnout. Great representation from the WERU listening area. really the only significant opposition was from multiple representatives of Central Maine Power and Emera Maine. They sent up lawyer after lawyer after lawyer to spin, the track record of those utilities, and to threaten all kinds of dire legal consequences if Maine dares to take its power into its own hands. And I was very unimpressed with their testimony. I thought they were entirely unconvincing. Their threats seemed very, very desperate and very empty. But there's no question that they will attempt to litigate this. And that's usually the the last resort of a lobbyist is to threaten litigation if a bill gets passed. You know, I've seen that again and again. When they don't have a case on the merits, then they threaten to litigate. And you know what I say? Bring it on. Fine. But they don't have a case.
I have to add right here, one of my favorite pieces of testimony was the person who likened this to an abusive relationship. And I hate to bring that up in the light of the fact that that is a serious situation, but we have a relationship that we need. We need that electricity, and we have people who are providing it to us, not maybe for the best cost or with the most reliability. And then when we complain about that, they tell us, you know, don't worry, we're going to get better. The billing issues are being fixed. And then we say, you know, we're not sure and we're scared. We'd like to do something different. And we want to leave. And then they threaten us. We can't leave, that there's just no way we can exist without them. And I found that parallel to be shocking, and it really opened my eyes to the fact that there comes a time when I think you need to do what's best and sever that tie. Right. I think we're at that point. Interestingly, I just opened up one of the Amera testimonies, and I found it to be surprising in rereading it. It's saying that there is the involuntary government taking of two companies who are not for sale. And I'm surprised to see this coming from the Amera lobbyists, because Amera is currently for sale. And one of the questions I have is, why would we approve selling Amera Maine to a consumer-owned utility or municipal-owned utility in Calgary when we could have it be sold to that exact same structure, but it would be the people?
Do they need approval from the PUC for a sale like that? And so conceivably, depending on where the legislation goes, the PUC could be a bump in the road for their approach that way.
Conceivably. You know, the current PUC is entirely LePage nominees, and they have been especially friendly to the utilities again and again. So I don't hold out a lot of hope necessarily that will happen, but it certainly, it's true that they make up their own minds ultimately and could impose conditions, and the legislature could act to impose conditions as well on that merger.
So if the bill passes, hypothetically, and we start moving down this path and they put up legal hurdles, I'll ask a naive, dumb question probably. Is there some eminent domain version of how this can happen? We would still pay them, but do it by eminent domain?
Yes, that's exactly right. There are essentially two legal lines of attack that are contemplated by the bill. First, we simply revoke their monopoly franchise. Maine law gives them a monopoly franchise at present over their service territory. They have captive customers because we allow that in Maine law. By revoking that franchise, we require them to sell, and we begin at net book value, which is the value that they themselves have reported to the PUC and to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as the value of the assets that we intend to purchase.
And they probably underestimated that for purposes of taxes. Is that correct?
The tax value is actually different, and they will. Part of what we need to analyze is you know, tax deferred asset values. I think they will argue that the net book value is not the right figure, and that they in fact need to be compensated at a much higher value. The biggest concern that they will raise is the concern for the investor. Their investors have, provided the upfront funding for poles and wires in Maine, and they are expecting a certain rate of return over the next 20 years in those investments. And therefore, we need to compensate them at a higher value than what they say those assets are worth now. So likely the proceedings would be either negotiated or settled in court. The law court has decided cases of this kind before, where there's a required taking of utility property, and the value would probably end up being something above the net book value, but it would be less than what Emera Maine and CMP claim that they're worth right now, as well. So the initial legal authority is the revocation of the utility franchise. What you go to after that is eminent domain, if necessary, because the state does have the power to take property if it is in the public interest to do so. And interestingly, we allow utilities to use eminent domain right now. So I found it very ironic when they said their initial response to the bill when we first held a press conference on it and launched it in late January was, oh, but our private property, you know, well, number one, we pay for that property with interest. And number two, you guys use eminent domain to take people's property, you know, all over the place. So, you know, the Maine Power Reliability Project, that power was used. And it's often used as a threat to get people to settle so that, you know, eminent domain isn't ultimately what is used. But, you know, there are people who were advised of the possibility of eminent domain. In the case of the CMP corridor, landowners along that way, and of course they're going to be a little more willing to settle before you get to the eminent domain proceeding in those instances. So those are the authorities that the state has. Two separate legal authorities that allow us to go forward with this, and that's why I think the utilities just don't have a case.
Mm. So let's imagine that the bill passes. What's the timeline of how you envision things happening? What's the big picture? How long would this take to actually close, if I can use that word?
So I think the shortest window in which it could be fully executed would be about 2 years, but it may take five. You know, it may be dragged out in court. I think, you know, the utilities will do everything that they can to throw up roadblocks and to drag it out. But, you know, Maine ultimately can control that. The bill itself contemplates a 2-year timeline, sends it directly to the law court to bypass lower courts and move it right to the ultimate authority if there is litigation. So, you know, I think it is a process that will take some time to execute fully, but it's one that is absolutely worth it's a journey that's absolutely worth embarking on, because we do need to take back our power. Our only way to address the climate crisis is to essentially triple the demands on the grid. We need to electrify transportation, and we need to electrify building heating and cooling. The grid, the electrical delivery system, is the foundation of that clean energy future. We can't build our dream home to survive the climate crisis if we don't have a foundation that is reliable and that is affordable and that is trustworthy. And right now, we're building on a cracked and crumbling foundation.
And we are probably still the most oil-reliant state in the country for home heating, and there's so many nice options out of there. Again, Efficiency Maine reports to your committee. Heat pumps are just a fantastic way to go. I mean, the previous owner of my house, I've said this on this program a few times before, burned 1,000 gallons of oil a year, and I'm using two heat pumps and haven't burned any oil for 2 years. You know, and I did put a wood stove in. There's certainly ways to get this done and that ought to happen. So relative to implementation, do you have any direct knowledge of how the Long Island process played out?
Yeah, it took some time. In the case of Long Island, it was especially complex in a way that our proposal is not. Long Island involved a brand new, incredibly expensive boondoggle of a nuclear power plant called Shoreham. And the Shoreham plant was essentially complete, and customers were on the hook for the entire cost of that plant when they realized that it was a terrible idea, that there was no way to evacuate Long Island in the case of a nuclear meltdown without going right past the plant itself. And Three Mile Island had recently happened, Chernobyl had recently happened, and people said, this is crazy, we can't go forward with it. And there had been cost overruns and other problems. So the whole proceeding in Long Island included the purchase of Shoreham, and the Long Island Power Authority, the consumer-owned utility, which was set up to replace LILCO, the preceding investor-owned utility, needed to incorporate the cost of that nuclear power plant. So very expensive, very complicated, and the process did take about 10 years to fully execute. But when the transition happened, rates went down by 20% for customers right away. And they have stayed lower than neighboring Con Edison ever since. So, you know, the utilities, you know, will point to some flaws in the Long Island Power Authority, and it has not been perfect. But it has retained lower rates than its investor-owned neighbor ever since. And those rate reductions that began in 1998 when the switchover happened have continued. And one thing we haven't really spoken about is that consumer-owned utilities are eligible for federal assistance, mm-hmm. federal disaster assistance. Superstorm Sandy had a devastating impact on utilities in the Long Island and New Jersey region. And the investor-owned utilities had to pass on the entire cost of the restoration to their customers. Just as in the October 2017 windstorm here in Maine, the investor-owned utilities passed on the cost of the restoration to customers.
And they made that case to the PUC that we need
additional
money, right?
Yeah. For CMP, where I live, it was $77 million. Amara was a little less, but still, you know, a disaster, the costs of a disaster are entirely footed by customers under our current investor-owned utility scheme. Consumer-owned utilities can receive federal disaster assistance. And so Long Island, the Long Island Power Authority, consumer-owned, received $898 million to assist with the restoration efforts after Superstorm Sandy. And that is a direct decrease or avoided increase, really, to customers. So another benefit of consumer-owned utilities.
All right. Well, we're coming to the end here, so I do appreciate your time. I just have one last quick question. Do we know where the governor stands on this?
The governor's energy office did testify neither for nor against the bill. They pointed out many of the benefits of consumer-owned power. I think they were cautious about, you know, going forward without having all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed. And I appreciate that caution. I think it's appropriate. The governor has met with me and other proponents of the bill. But I'm optimistic that we can move forward together on this. And I would encourage people to call their legislators, call their state representative, Nicole Grahowski. She's already supported, by the way. Call, Louis Lucchini or Aaron Herbig or whoever your state senator is in the ERU listening area. And call the governor as well and express your support. 287-3531 is the number for the governor's office. I believe governor@maine.gov is the email address. And, you know, certainly people should weigh in and express their opinion on this or any other legislation.
And I suspect that a vote will happen before our July show. This is our June show. But I assuming it goes forward, I'm sure we will be covering this again here on Power for the People. So thanks very much to Representative Seth Berry, Representative Nicole Grokowski, and this is Power for the People. We will see you next month.